Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
Hello and welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about the poetry of En Hedwana. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Sophus Hell, a writer, translator, and cultural historian who is a regular contributor to Danish newspapers. His brand new book is En Hedwana, The Complete Poems of the World's First Author, and you can learn more about him and his work at his website, sophushell.com, which is spelled SOPHUSHELLE.com. He joins us by Zoom from Berlin as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station, WRFH in Michigan. Sophus, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Thank you so much, John. Thank you for having me.
Why is The Poetry of En Hedwana a great book?
Well, there's a couple of reasons for that. And I think we can't get around the fact that one of those reasons is that En Hedwana holds this very special place in literary history. She marks the beginning of authorship in a very real way. With En Hedwana's poems, we see the first time that we can link a poem to a person we can identify in the historical record. But quite aside from that, they're also just great poems. They have a particularly impressive use of metaphor and these very striking images that are used to describe the might of the goddess Inanna. And they're also very self-reflexive poetry. These are poems that think about what poetry does, how it works, how it acts in the world. So those are some of the reasons that make this poetry great literature.
We're going to talk about all that, the content of these poems, the context in which they arose. But I want to start off with the fact that she is, as you say in the subtitle of your new book, the world's first author. She's the first author whose name we know. So first of all, Sophus, how do we know that much? How do we know her name?
Well, I mean, I think it's also worth just saying that this is the first poetry where we can link it to an author, as I said, but it's far from the first poetry. There are texts and poems and stories that are much, much older than her. And like En Hedwana, it's a staggeringly long time ago. Like we go back to the 23rd century BCE, but even she has literary precursors. It's just that all of that literature that comes before her is anonymous. But En Hedwana's name is part and parcel of the poem themselves. She appears in two of them as one of the main characters of the poems. However, there is a good deal of debate, and we might get to that later, about whether the historical person in Hedwana, who we know to have existed, is the same as the author and the narrator of these poems, or whether they were written after her death in her name, sort of like in the equivalent of like ancient historical fiction, that kind of thing. But En Hedwana we know to have been a real person, in part because she was the daughter of the Emperor Sargon, who in the 23rd century BCE created the world's first empire and installed his daughter as high priestess in the city of Ur. And we have some of her servants who have left behind cylinder seals inscribed with her name, you know, saying, oh, I am the servant of En Hedwana. And these seals are like ancient form of identity. So it's kind of like the ancient equivalent of having a signature, and people would have on these seals their profession. And so we know from these seals that she's a real historical person. And she also left behind an inscription from her own time in which she shows herself performing an offering, that she's a real historical person. And then we have these poems from a later period in which she appears as narrator and as author.
Well, let's jump into that question of authorship right now. Do you think she's the actual author of these poems, or is she a character only?
Well, it's a really good question. And scholars have debated this for, you know, now some 50 years. And the short answer is that we don't really know. But you're also asking my opinion. I think probably what happened is that Inhidwana wrote something and that then something was revised and rewritten and expanded over the next centuries. She dies sometimes around 2200 BCE, and the earliest manuscripts of her poem are from 500 years later. And that's not in itself unusual, because the manuscripts come from a period, which we call the Old Babylonian period, where almost all our knowledge of Sumerian literature comes from. So we have this explosion of manuscripts in the 1740s BCE. So it's quite normal. Like, it's not in itself, let's say, alarming that we know these poems from this later period. That's quite standard. But we don't know, again, how much happened in those 500 years. But either way, she is an incredibly interesting historical character. And as I like to say, authorship is born with her, regardless of the accuracy of these attributions, because the very idea that you can attribute a poem to a single identifiable person, that idea is born with Inhidwana.
And what's the significance of that, this idea of authorship, the concept that there is a person behind the words?
Well, it makes her literature a lot more personal. And like, you really read these poems as a very personal tale of her particular plight. You really get drawn into the drama of her facing off this rebellion that tries to exile her from her city, and cast her out from being high priestess. So she's forced to wander the thorns of foreign lands and so on and so forth. It makes the more general genre in which she writes, which is the genre of hymns that are addressed to the goddess, it gives it a lot of drama, a lot of personal flair that it ties into her specifically. And also, she is just such an interesting figure. She lived at such an interesting moment in time. So the figure of the author really anchors her during this dramatic period in which she lived. But also more generally, like, it is a huge shift in the history of literature. Literature goes from being seen as something that is part of a collective tradition and that is owned by everybody who participates in that collective tradition, to something that is the creation of a single people. And that's, that notion of authorship is with us to this day. That's still how we see authors today.
She wrote in Sumerian, and Sumeria is the first or one of the first civilizations we often hear about. She lived in the city of Ur, as you mentioned, modern-day Iraq, more than 4,000 years ago. What's the significance of her as a Sumerian? What was that civilization like? How do we learn about it through her words?
Well, it's interesting to think of her as Sumerian because she both is and isn't Sumerian. So this is a period in time where the area that we would now call southern Iraq is characterized by two languages that are intermingling. There is Sumerian and there is Akkadian. And Akkadian is a Semitic language, which means it's a lot like Arabic and Hebrew and so on and so forth. And Sumerian is what we call an isolate, meaning that it's like nothing at all. It's an extremely odd and interesting language that really is like nothing else in a very real way. And Inhidwana's father, I mentioned him earlier, King Sargon, he unites what had previously been a set of independent city-states to create this empire. And before Sargon, Sumerian and Akkadian were somewhat on equal footing, but Sargon introduces Akkadian as a state language, and that sets in motion a slow decline of the Sumerian language. So it eventually dies out, and Akkadian becomes the language that people speak. And Akkadian then morphs into, among other things, the Babylonian language and the Assyrian language that we know from later. But so at this time, both languages are existing side by side. And it might be that Inhidwana spoke Akkadian as her mother tongue and then learned Sumerian later, which would make it particularly impressive, because these poems are written not just in Sumerian, but these are some of they are arguably the pinnacle of Sumerian literature. They really take the Sumerian language and they strain it and they stretch it to do something entirely new with it, to express the power of this goddess that they're addressing, the goddess Inanna. So Inhidwana exists between two traditions. She is representative of an Akkadian-speaking empire in a city, Ur, that would have been dominated by more Sumerian-speaking peoples, and peoples who probably resented her presence quite a lot because she was a representative of this new empire. So she's trying to bridge traditions, I think is the short way of putting it.
her work comes down to us because of cuneiform writing on clay tablets. Remind us quickly, what is cuneiform?
So cuneiform is a writing system, just like our Latin letters. It's the oldest writing system, which means that when writing was invented, it was cuneiform that was invented. It's also one of the longest lasting writing systems. It was created sometimes around 3500 BC, so more than 1,000 years before Nhidwana. And then it continued to be used up until the first century AD. So that's 3.5 millennia of use. And cuneiform was mainly used to write these two languages I've been talking about, Sumerian and Akkadian, though it was also adapted to write a whole host of other languages as well. Cuneiform really is a wonderful writing system. It's relatively complicated. It's not a walk in the park, but it's really also a very rewarding, very rich writing system that can do all sorts of cool things that we can't with our relatively impoverished alphabetic scripts. And it's a gorgeous writing system. It really is. And one of the main features for a historian of cuneiform as a writing system is that it's mostly, not only, but mostly written on clay tablets, as you mentioned. And clay is just the most amazing writing material, in part because it's, you know, so cheap. It's so easy to, you know, you can just literally pick it up from the ground, unlike parchment and papyrus, which were very expensive to produce, which, you know, meant that cuneiform could be more widely used. But also clay is just incredibly durable. Like parchment and papyrus don't last very long. Clay is just clay, you know, and that's why we have these texts that are 4,000 years old, because clay is so durable as a writing material. So we have so many sources. We have truly an outrageous amount of sources from ancient Iraq.
Let's jump into the actual poetry then of Nhidwana. And her best known work is called The Exaltation of Inanna. It takes up about a dozen pages in your book. The lines are really short, but give us an overview. What is this poem like?
So I should just say very briefly that the lines are only short in my translation, and that's because I've introduced these line breaks to recreate what I see as like the flow of the poem, because the lines are so tight in Sumerian that like when I rendered an English translation, they became so long and bulky. So I cut them up. But yeah, so you're right. The poem consists of 153 lines, and it is the story of how Nhidwana, who is the high priestess of the moon god Nanna in the city of Ur, she is cast into exile by a rebel named Lugalane. So that's the drama of the poem. Nhidwana has lost her power as high priestess, and she is wandering in exile. And she prays to the god that she had served as high priestess, the god Nanna, who is the god of the moon. But he doesn't intervene. He doesn't answer her one way or another. So she feels that she is in limbo. She compares the situation to an open court case that hasn't been resolved one way or the other. And so in her rather desperate situation, she prays instead to the moon god's daughter, Inanna. So these gods are easily confused, Nanna and Inanna. But Inanna is the focus of this poem and of other poems attributed to Nhidwana as well.
And Inanna has another name, maybe a more familiar name, which is Ishtar.
Exactly. So Inanna is the Sumerian name and Ishtar is the Akkadian name. And she really is the most spectacular goddess that you'll ever hear about. She is really incredible. In some texts, she appears as the goddess of war, in others as the goddess of sex. I think for Nhidwana, she is first and foremost the goddess of change, of transformation, of metamorphosis, of contradiction, of paradox. That's how she depicts her. She depicts her as a goddess who is always changeable herself and always changing everything around her. And a large part of the appeal of these poems is how beautifully and how powerfully they evoke the power of Inanna, who is this stunning cosmic figure. And I think it's, you know, in the poems that are attributed to Nhidwana, she makes Inanna the ruler of the universe. Like, that is what these poems are meant to do. They are meant to take Inanna and put her at the very top of the pantheon, replacing the previous rulers of the gods, who are these male gods, like the moon god Nanna, but also the god Enlil, or the god of the heavens, who is An. They are replaced by Inanna, who is this incredibly powerful female force that is at the same time a power of chaos and a power of unpredictability. And so in the exaltation, we then get this appeal to Inanna that she may help Nhidwana in her desperate situation as she's in exile. But then the poem sort of starts to alluding to its own breakdown, because in Hedwana says that she's losing her eloquence. So she's losing the very power of words that she will need to appeal to Inanna and convince Inanna to help her. And so that's really the drama of the poem. It's a poem about will in Hedwana succeed in composing the hymn that we're actually reading right now, and get Inanna to help her. And in the end, she succeeds. So the poem sort of solves its own problem because she finally gets the words out. And those are the words that we're reading. And so Inanna is magnified, she's glorified, and she, as we are told in an epilogue, steps in and restores Inhidwana to power. So it's a poem that kind of depicts itself being made and depicts how the poem itself changes the course of history, which is part of what I was talking about. Like, it's a poem that's very self-reflective in that sense.
There's a striking line in the Exaltation, and I know you like it because you borrow from it for a title to an essay in your book. And I should say, your book on the complete poems of the world's first author, you have not only the translation of the actual poems, but a great introduction and then some essays in the back that help us understand what these poems are. But this is the line, this is the striking line, quote, "My honey mouth is full of froth, my soothing words are turned to dust." Why do you like that line?
I do love it. I really do love it. I think it's such an interesting line, in part because just the metaphor of the honeyed mouth is such a good description of what these poems feel like in Sumerian. Like, I think honey is such a perfect metaphor for Inhidwana's style, because honey, on one hand, it's like, it's sweet. And these poems are beautiful. They really are. They're a pleasure to read. They feel good in one's mouth because of their play of sounds and so on and so forth. But there is also something about honey that is so, you know, viscous and so like thick, and that is what these poems are. They're incredibly dense, and sometimes they can be so dense that they're hard to make sense of because they just pack so much meaning together. Like, you don't want to eat a whole meal of honey, and like, in a sense, like, that is what reading these poems is like. They're so compact, densely layered, that it can really be an overwhelming reading experience, especially in the Sumerian. So that's one of the reasons I like this line. It's just a good description of what it feels like to read the poems. But also, it's an interesting moment in which the poet says, this poem that I am writing is one I'm struggling to write, you know? As one of my colleagues put it, this is the first text to contain a depiction of authorship, but it's also the first text to contain a depiction of a writer's block, you know, because her honey mouth has turned to frost. And overcoming that moment of crisis is what the poem is all about.
I'm also attracted to this idea, my soothing words are turned to dust. They come to us on clay tablets, which of course can break and literally turn to dust.
Oh, that's a good point, yeah.
What is the history of these poems? I'm a little surprised, I've never heard of this author before I saw your book. Is there a continuous tradition of people reading and appreciating the poems of Inhidwana, or were they lost and then recovered?
Very much the latter. So Inhidwana lives in this very dramatic historical period. That's, you know, this first empire with all this, you know, it's such an interesting time where so much is going on, so much, like, the world really is growing during this period. And it's a period of artistic innovation and technological developments and so on and so forth, but also of huge social instability and constant revolts. And that's when Inhidwana lives. And then we get 500 years where we don't really hear much about Inhidwana. And then as I said earlier, we get this explosion of manuscripts in what we call the Old Babylonian period, where school children are using Inhidwana's poems to learn this language in which they are written, Sumerian, which had died out in the intervening centuries. So people are studying Sumerian in school, much like people would study, you know, Latin in Europe and even in the US. And you can imagine sort of like, this is the ancient equivalent of British school children being made to learn Virgil, because Virgil connotes Latin, but also eloquence and refinement. In the same way, Inhidwana has that very special place. She is, you know, the master of the Sumerian language. So by studying Inhidwana, you will become a cultured person. And that's the sort of status that she has in the old Babylonian schools, as we call them. But then not long after that, there's a change in the curriculum, and Inhidwana and other texts are sort of thrown out. So she disappears from the memory, even even of the Babylonians, around the middle of the second millennium BCE, so around year 1500, she sort of disappears from the record. And then, you know, she was only rediscovered in the 20th century. I think very fitting for an author who lived through so many rebellions herself, the first English translation of the poems appeared in 1968 in the middle of the student rebellion. But she's sort of been leading a bit of a quiet life since 1968. Like, she is... There have been some meditations of her and some engagement with her, especially in feminist circle and among like people from Iraq who have rediscovered their poetic legacy and so on and so forth and their cultural heritage, but not really a lot. And it's only actually within the last couple of years that Enheduanna is really being rediscovered. And there was a massive change in just last year with an exhibition at the Morgan Library in New York that really propelled her to greater fame. My colleagues have come up with this great phrase to describe Enheduanna's history, which is that Enheduanna has led three lives. There's first the first life of the historical person during Sargon's empire. And then there's the second life of her being a literary superstar in these schools. And then there's her third life, which is the current one. And that is really only just beginning now, I think.
You make the point in the introduction that since her modern rediscovery during this third life of hers, she's been a victim of academic disputes, these complicated scholarly questions overwhelming the literature, and we maybe treated her works more like artifacts than like art.
I definitely think that's the case. I definitely think that's an excellent summary of it. And like, even in this podcast episode, I could feel myself wanting to get this question of, did she write the poems? Did she not write the poems? Are they written later in her name? Kind of out of the way, because that is the discussion that has dominated so much of Enheduanna's reception in scholarship over the past century. Like, that is what people have been talking about when they have been talking about Enheduanna. And sure, that's one feature of the poems, but there are so many other interesting things to talk about. And these are literary masterpieces in my mind. They're absolutely stunning works of poetry. And there's so much more to be explored. I've written two books on the literature of the ancient Near East, one on Gilgamesh, the Babylonian epic, and one on Enheduanna. And on Gilgamesh, when I was, you know, trying to write about the poem, there's so much interesting research that I wanted to summarize and present and, you know, weave together and point to all of the cool people who have done such cool work on Gilgamesh. And it's not like no one has written on Enheduanna, and I tried, you know, to integrate as much of existing research as I could in my book, but it's just so much less, so much less. There's so much more to be done, and I really feel like with Enheduanna, even more so than with Gilgamesh, we're the beginning of a journey of rediscovery and celebration that I'm just very happy to be part of.
I'm glad you brought up Gilgamesh, because I was wondering about that. In this podcast series, we covered the Epic of Gilgamesh. It's show number 129 in this series. I think that's the oldest, until now, the oldest work we've discussed on the Great Books podcast. Is there any kind of connection between Enheduanna and Gilgamesh, other than the curiosity they both come from Mesopotamia?
I mean, having written a book on both, I am the right person to ask, but I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, there is no smoking gun. That's the short answer. There is not like a direct connection. Both of them have this quality of self-reflexiveness. Both of them spend a lot of time thinking about themselves as poems, and that is, I think, what draws me to both of them. Both of them are gorgeous as poems, but if there is a connection, it's very indirect as far as I can tell. There isn't like a line that recurs from one and the other. And Gilgamesh's depiction of the same goddess who is, you know, so celebrated by Enheduanna, the goddess Ishtar, as she's called in Gilgamesh. You know, in Gilgamesh, she's treated as this, you know, the laughable character almost. It's really like an anti-Ishtar text. So in that sense, it's the complete opposite. And Gilgamesh is this narrative poem. It's fairly, I would say, jaunty even. Like it rolls along well, it carries the reader on a journey. Whereas Enheduanna is, again, has this honey-like quality of thunder in the clouds almost, that you're not quite sure what's going on, but something very powerful is going on.
In addition to the Exaltation of Inanna, your book on the complete poems of Enheduanna, we get the hymn to Inanna. We also get the temple hymns, as you call them. They're 42 odes, a kind of anthology. But give us a quick overview then of what else besides the exaltation is in your book.
Yeah, so besides the exaltation, there is, I mean, one of the other great poems that is attributed to Inhidwana is called the Hymn to Inanna. And the exaltation, one of the reasons it's so cool is that it has this long autobiographical element of Inhidwana struggling in exile. And in the hymn, there probably was an autobiographical section, but it's missing. The text is broken at the most frustrating point imaginable. But the hymn is also itself spectacular. And the hymn is even more radical than the exaltation in describing Inanna. And I was saying earlier that Inhidwana depicts this goddess as a goddess of change and contradiction. And we really get that in the hymn with this stunning section in the middle of the poem that lists the goddess's various contradictory attributes. So that's a really wonderful section. Apart from that, there are these temple hymns, which are, let's be honest, a bit more of a challenge for modern readers. A hymn is a dead genre, by and large, and a hymn to a building is a really dead genre, but it sort of gives you a tantalizing glimpse of the Sumerian world. And I think that gives the temple hymns an almost like ethnographic quality, that you sort of get glimpses of these various cities that even in the ancient world were seen as these like ancient curiosities. Apart from that, the book contains an introduction to Inhidwana's world, the life that she, like as much as we can say about the life that she led, the historical period in which she lived, and how her poems were received. I discuss the main themes of the poems, including questions around power, questions around gender, and so on and so forth. And then I discuss their modern reception.
If you had asked me who was the world's first author before I'd heard of Inhidwana, if you'd asked me that question, I would have said Homer or Hesiod or at least a guy, a man, right? And yet, now we discover it's a woman, and that's a major point of interest. What are we to make of that? To what extent is this poem female?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. And I like the way you phrase it. To what extent is this poem female? I mean, it's not conventionally female. It is a celebration of a very powerful female figure, Inanna. So in that sense, it's like insistently female. But Inanna is not a conventional female figure, nor is Inhidwana herself as conventional female figure. Inhidwana was a high priestess, and as such, she would have been removed from the normal world of women in the time in which she lived. High priestesses were figures of great political and economic authority, as best as we can tell. There's some debate about that, but I really do believe that they're figures of great power in this period. High priestesses also were not allowed to have children, and they did not have husbands because they were seen as being married to the god that they served. And so this framework that would, for so many women at the time, have determined the course of their life, who was their father, who was their husband, who was their child, well, that doesn't apply to high priestesses because they don't have any kids, they don't have children, and they're married to a god. So their position is enormously different from that of other women. And there is a point in the poem where Inhidwana seems to compare herself to these figures who have some sort of non-binary or gender-bending status, perhaps indicating that she herself is on the margins of conventional femininity. So they are figures, like they are poems about what we might call female empowerment, but in a very interesting way. And Inanna is in some sources depicted as like the feminine, the uber feminine, and in other texts she is depicted as the opposite of everything that women are supposed to be. So I would say that the poem have an important but ambivalent relation to femininity.
How did you discover her? And more broadly, how did you get into this kind of literature and become a scholar of it and learn how to read it and translate it?
Yeah, looking back, I do sometimes wonder at the series of steps that led me here. As for where I discovered Inhidwana, like that was my first year in university studies. She was on the curriculum of we were doing, you know, Sumerian literature. She was part of that introduction, and it was really love at first sight. So when I was asked to write a term paper on a topic of my choice, I chose Inhidwana, and that was, you know, that was a decade ago. And I'm still writing about Inhidwana and thinking about her. And she really has fascinated me. And I had, you know, 10 years ago, that same impression that you had now. Like, why have I not heard of this person before? This is such an interesting historical figure with such an amazing body of literature connected to them. How did I not know this person already? I think that's the question that I had back then and I still have now. As for how I came to study this region, like, I think when I was, you know, when I was 17, I had this idea that I wanted to go as far back in time as possible. And this, you know, period really is where our earliest sources begin. And I think I had this illusion, I guess, that by going as far back as possible, I could find something foundational, you know, that like this is where it begins. And, you know, that will tell us something about human history. But of course, when you it's like a receding horizon. The further back you go, the more you realize that there's always more history behind it. And you don't ever get to a place of pure beginning, because there's always more, more messy beginnings behind each beginning, and so on and so forth. And so I didn't really get to that oldest possible place that I was dreaming of as a teenager, but I found myself studying these cultures, the Sumerian and the Babylonian, and these literary masterpieces that I really felt have been overlooked and haven't been given their due. And all of my work since has been in popularizing them and bringing them to the attention and the fame that I think works like Inhidwana and like Gilgamesh deserve.
Your new book, your brand new book, is Inhidwana, The Complete Poems of the World's First Author. It's out from Yale University Press. It has an introduction, it has text, it has essays, notes. What are you trying to accomplish with this volume?
I'm trying to put Inhidwana at the head of the literary canon. I want Inhidwana to be the first text that people meet when they start studying literary history, because she is a chronological beginning, and she makes for a great introduction to everything that literature can do at its best. So I think she belongs in the canon, and she belongs at the head of the canon.
At the head of the canon, the Western canon at least, usually is Homer, sometimes Gilgamesh, but usually Homer, very often Homer. She predates Homer by 1,500 years. To what extent is she a part of our cultural inheritance? And by that, I mean we as Westerners. Is this work Western in any meaningful way?
That's a really good question. And I think different readers will feel differently about that question. I think some readers are really drawn to Inhidwana because she represents an alternative to Western literature. And some see in her a continuity to the situation in which they find themselves in. I think with Gilgamesh, there can be all sorts of debates, and people can go back and forth about, you know, did Homer read Gilgamesh, basically? you can ask that question a little more with a little more nuance, but that's the basic question, right? Within Inhidwana, we can be absolutely certain that Homer did not read Inhidwana, nor did Sappho read Inhidwana, for that matter. With Gilgamesh, again, people debate, like, what is the exact relation to the Bible? And again, there can be all sorts of arguments about that. But Inhidwana, again, if she had any influence at all on let's say, Hebrew literature, then it was through a long series of intermediaries. So in that sense, like, she is so old that the connection to the classics of the Western canon is indirect at best, if it even exists. So she is really part of a different world. But at the same time, you can really see themes in her poetry that are just as relevant today, including questions about the relation between, you know, gender and power, as well as these are poems that are set in a world that's really socially turbulent and that is full of social divisions and social revolt, which is unfortunately also a fair description of the world in which we're living now. Inhidwana lived during a time of huge technological acceleration. and huge advances in all sorts of fields, but also a sense of like ongoing disaster that, you know, culminated in the collapse of this very short-lived empire that she was part of. And that sense of like things move speedily, but also sometimes things to be going in the wrong direction is, I think, also one we can unfortunately relate to today. And last but not least, in Hidwana, lived during probably a time of dramatic climate change, not man-made climate change as we're seeing today, but still changes in the atmosphere that led to things like famine, which again also unfortunately does seem to be part of our historical moment. So there are points of connection to the present, even if she is also quite like resolutely outside of the Western canon as we usually understand it.
One more question, just sum it all up for us then. What is the case for treating Enheduanna as more than a mere curiosity? What is the case for reading her words now?
I think I would just like to end by stressing something I haven't perhaps stressed enough, which is that these poems, you know, they are literary time bombs. They don't read dustily. They read explosively. And one of the reasons that they lived explosively, I mentioned this at the very beginning, are the images, the metaphors that they use to really strain the language, but also to strain the mind of the reader to comprehend something that is beyond our comprehension. And I think we often treat ancient deities as kind of quaint figures, like, you know, Zeus with his little lightning bolt. But to the ancient people, these gods were figures of absolutely cosmic power. And I really got a sense of what it might be like to have a confrontation with ancient divinity by reading these poems, because they create a sense of awe. And I think Enheduanna is best read alongside other religious poets of the ages that also do crazy, almost avant-garde things with words to express something that is beyond the normal reach of human language. So poets like Gerald Manley Hopkins or Pindar or even Emily Dickinson in her own way. I think that is one way to approach Enheduanna, as a deeply moving poet who stretches our sense of the world and instills a real sense of like chaos, but also awe into our relation to the world.
Sophus Hell, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about the poetry of Enheduanna.
Thank you.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at heymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is at heymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.